themselves is even more intense and complicated than in other unloved daughters. Common effects of the unreliable maternal style: heightened and even extreme lack of trust, emotional volatility and inability to self-regulate, replication of the mother bond by being attracted to abusive people, being drawn to controlling friends and lovers because she mistakes control for consistency and reliability, impaired emotional intelligence and ability to identify and process emotions, an intensified version of the core conflict with heightened emotional confusion. The self-involved mother. In recent years, this type of unloving mother, the one high in narcissistic traits, has garnered the most press and even spawned acronyms in the world of self-help: the NM, narcissistic mother, and DONM, daughter of NM. This mother is the sun of her own universe, and her children revolving planets. Her treatment of them is completely self-referential and superficial, and, not surprisingly, she's incapable of real attunement because she's low on empathy. This mother exerts control over her children, but in much more subtle, less overt ways than her controlling counterpart. She favors the children who reflect well on her and ostracizes those who don't by belittling them. Like a combative mother, she is a mistress of the put-down when necessary and enjoys pitting one family member against another. People high in narcissistic traits are also game players. They glow in the light of adulation. They need it to thrive, but they also need to feel the rush of power. They play games, setting one child against another, giving extra points and gold stars to those who make her feel completely in control. They are verbally abusive, specialize in scapegoating, and cover their tracks with charm and a perfectly maintained facade. Perhaps one reason labeling unloving mothers as narcissists has had so much popular appeal is that they take total advantage of the imbalance of power implicit in motherhood discussed in the first chapter. Given the taboos about criticizing mothers, the self-involved one is easy to target once you've figured out who she is. The story shared by Laura, now 41, brilliantly captures what life is like with this kind of mother. It appears to have all begun when this seemingly ordinary child was deemed extraordinary by others. There was definitely a clear delineation between the years before I got slapped with the gifted label by my teachers and after. Before, she couldn't have cared less about me. I was just this nuisance she had to tend to all day when she'd rather be watching her soap operas. After I was labeled, I think she saw me as having potential value she could exploit. The irony here is that Laura also confides that this turning point, seized upon by her mother, was actually unwelcome for her. She didn't like the attention, hated being singled out, and wanted nothing more than to blend in at school. That was not going to happen with her mother around. Suddenly, she became very interested in being a parental helper in my classes at school when she never wanted to be involved before. She did not show this same interest in my brother or his classes. My mother took it upon herself to swoop in and make sure everyone was focused on me. She was also hypercritical of my teachers and my school, often acting like she knew more than they did. She was in the habit of criticizing assigned reading material and lesson plans, for instance, saying things like, "This isn't challenging enough for my daughter. She is exceptional and needs to be challenged." And, needless to say, it became totally about her, as Laura recounts. She also became hypercritical of me, my interests, my friends, how I spent my free time, everything. My feelings and actual interests were not considered important. When their existence was acknowledged at all, often I'd try to communicate what I liked or didn't like the way any kid would. "Mom, I like mashed potatoes, but I don't like yogurt." She'd come back at me with information about my own feelings. Don't be silly. You love yogurt. You don't want mashed potatoes. Mashed potatoes are fattening, and you don't want to grow up to be fat. If something about me or my personality wasn't perfectly in line with what she wanted it to be, she'd do everything she could to convince me to change it, often berating interests and emerging values I had that didn't fit the mold while encouraging substitutes of her choosing. This is a form of psychological control. In many ways, Laura's story functions as a summary of what it's like to be the daughter of a mother high in narcissistic traits. First, there's the mother seizing an opportunity to aggrandize herself through her child, both literally and symbolically. Once again, what matters most is the outside world's perception, not what the daughter is feeling or what she actually wants. Second, her marginalization of her daughter's thoughts and feelings, especially if they don't coincide with her own, often leaves this daughter feeling fraudulent and ignored, despite her achievements. No child really wins or gets what she or he needs in this household, but one child's success with the queen bee and another's failure may not make that obvious. Laura's brother, for example, grew up on a steady diet of, "Why can't you be more like your sister?" with a self-involved mother, you're either on team mom or rejected from it. And if you find yourself in the off position, the chances are good that you'll be scapegoated and picked on. These mothers care deeply about how they look to the outside world, so there's a lot of pressure on the children in the household to succeed and to shine, since they are essentially ambassadors for how terrific mom is. Perhaps the most dangerous and psychologically important lesson the self-involved mother imparts is that attention is earned, never given freely or without condition. And whatever attention's available is sparingly doled out in substitutes for love. It's as though saplings under the canopy in the rainforest are duking it out for a glimmer of sunlight. Is it any wonder that the sorties, skirmishes, and battles orchestrated by the queen among and between siblings endure through childhood and all of adulthood? Not surprisingly, since all the attention is focused on external success, no use talking to this particular mother about someone's soulfulness or character. Many daughters become high achievers because that's what it takes to have a favored position in mom's orbit. Their achievements, though, don't fill the void in their hearts left by their mother's lack of attunement or by their recognition of how tenuous the emotional connection is. Perhaps the most poisonous part of a self-involved mother's legacy is the idea that love has to be earned. This puts the daughter in a position where she's always trying to figure out what she can do to wrest her mother's love from her. It is a thankless task and impossible to fulfill. And then, of course, there's the odd girl out, the girl who either can't ever win her mother's approval or who is necessary to the mother's gamesmanship in the family. We'll look at gaslighting and scapegoating and other manipulative tactics later in the chapter in depth, but for the daughter of the self-involved mother, whether she's the trophy child who can do no wrong or the odd girl out, she has been indelibly shaped by her mother's behaviors. How a daughter is affected by the self-involved mother. Attached from her own feelings and thoughts, and has trouble identifying them. Lacking in real self-esteem and dependent on others for superficial validation. Unhappy, but doesn't see the source because she accepts her situation as normal. Trouble with intimacy and closeness. Feels lonely and adrift without knowing why. Attracted to others high in narcissistic traits. Deeply immersed in the core conflict if she's the odd girl out. The trophy child is unlikely to recognize the conflict at all. The combative mother. This mother takes winning and absolute control of the household and the children in it very seriously, and she can get angry at the drop of a hat. She considers herself feisty and outspoken, not tyrannical and repressive, and she's often proud of how tough she is because she thinks it gives her authority and agency. The truth is that sometimes she's a bully who's bullied by a hot-tempered and tightly wound husband, but not always. In other households, the father may simply be an appeaser, absenting himself from parenting and permitting his wife to run the ship as she sees fit. In addition to being highly combative, these mothers are often hypercritical, determined that life look perfect, at least from the outside. They don't tolerate any deviation from the rules they've set, and they're not shy about voicing their displeasure. Woe to the child who ignores her. Like a narcissistic or self-involved mother, the combative mother largely sees her child or children as an extension of herself, and she has high standards that have to be met. Once again, there's a great disconnect between what is seen by the outside world and what goes on in private, as Jerry's story makes clear. My mother's public self was carefully cultivated. She was always beautifully groomed and careful to appear thoughtful to others. She was the first to volunteer for a bake sale or charity drives, but at home, she was a tyrant and a screamer. It was horribly confusing to try to figure out who my mother was, the one who berated me for being too fat and lazy, or the woman the neighbors all admired for her gardening skills and her baked goods. No wonder I didn't tell anyone. Who would have believed me? My own mother was highly combative, and I, too, was confused by the switches between her public self and the private one. The world thought my mother was charming and beautiful. The other thing that was confusing was I could see that she liked being angry and yelling at me. I knew that, even as a little girl, and it scared me. Of course, the idea that a mother would actually enjoy berating her child runs counter to every cultural trope we hold dear about motherhood. That's why these daughters keep their silence long past childhood, and mothers rationalize and justify their combative behaviors. As one daughter recounted, "I thought my mother was doing it for our own good. Those constant fights to make us tougher, the lectures about how only the strong survive. I believed that until I was in my early 30s, when I finally noticed the way I'd been damaged and my siblings had been hurt. I wasn't tough. I was a fearful person with armor against the world. My mother liked the power her anger gave her, I think. She still does. She thrives on drama, trying to set me against my siblings or my siblings against me. But when I finally realized that about her and said so, my three siblings turned on me like a united front." This mother's brand of aggression is largely verbal, although she may resort to physical aggression from time to time. She rationalizes her hypercriticality and verbal abuse, insisting that her words are a necessary corrective given her child's flaws. Or she justifies words and actions by saying she was provoked. The denial is another layer of abuse. The constant pattern of shifting the blame from her own behavior onto her child's shoulders is, in and of itself, abusive. The combative mother guards her territory fiercely, and while she wants her children to validate her, she's also competitive. That can yield even more confusion, as Karen, now 42, related. "My mother had been a beauty queen, and she was very proud of her looks. I was the only girl and super cute as a small child. The photos of me look as if I'm a China doll, dressed to the nines. She looks proud and beaming, but as I got older, how pretty I was bothered her. She criticized everything I did. She screamed my inadequacies and mocked my failures. It was horrible. I didn't get it, and I just kept trying to please her. Strangely, it was my grandmother, her mother, who explained it to me right before I left for college in two words. She's jealous." That was the first inkling I had that I had done nothing to deserve her wrath. The combative mother shapes a daughter in specific ways. Imagine a seedling planted too close to the gutters of a house, pelted to the ground every time it rains, and you have an accurate picture of what it's like to be a child in these circumstances. Many daughters, not surprisingly, go down for the count as children. They become fearful and guarded, terrified of making a mistake. They hide in plain sight. Others report that they just muzzled themselves out of fear during their adolescent years. One daughter wrote to ask, "Is it true that teenage girls actually challenge their mothers?" I answered by saying it was normal and weird if they didn't, and then she and 10 others chimed in with pretty much the same response. I would have been cut to ribbons if I'd done that. The roles the daughters of combative mothers take on. The home as battleground spawns different ways of coping, each damaging to daughters in different ways. Based on interviews with many women, I've given them wholly unscientific names because my evidence is anecdotal, but they capture what happens in broad strokes. The appeaser. This daughter becomes a peacemaker or a pleaser, doing what she can to turn down the volume and velocity of fights. She's often timid and so focused on stopping potential conflict that she forgets her own needs and wants, if she can even recognize them. Unfortunately, these girls often end up in relationships with people who take advantage of their need to please, a pattern that usually persists into and through adulthood. The scrapper. This daughter takes on her mother in many ways, but can get tripped up by both fighting her mother and wanting her love at the same time. It's a specific variation on the core conflict. Management of emotion is often a problem for these daughters, most specifically anger, because it's aroused by old triggers very quickly. These daughters also have difficulty distinguishing among emotions, confusing hurt with anger. The avoidant. This daughter will do anything to dodge conflict of any kind. She's learned to armor herself, living with a combative mother, and she's distrustful of people. The problem is that in her effort to live conflict-free, she's also missing out on the possibility of close connection, which is something she actually wants. Because she doesn't really trust anyone deep down, she's more likely to fold her tents and flee than to try to work out difficulties with anyone. In many senses, she is the most wounded of the daughters who came of age in the combat zone. The combative mother is the easiest to spot on the surface, but she leaves behind a complicated legacy of fear. Common effects of the combative mother. Daughter's impaired ability to identify and manage her feelings. High reactivity to even the hint of conflict. Difficulty with intimacy and closeness. Maladaptive behaviors when there's any kind of interpersonal tension. Problems regulating emotions. The enmeshed mother. Maxie, 69, was 14 and her brother was 10 when her mother came home to discover that her husband and their father had left them. The apartment looked as if it had been robbed. He'd taken the furniture, the linens, the art on the walls, the dishes, and cookware. Only our clothes remained. My mother was a salesgirl at a store, and there was no way we could live on her salary. My father didn't want to pay her much in alimony or child support, so he dragged things out so she'd cave in and accept whatever crumbs he offered. Instead, she borrowed money and merchandise and started a business, and my brother and I worked in it. It became very successful. I lived at home until I was 29. My mother needed me, and moved into an apartment she picked out for me that was 5 minutes away. She hired the interior designer and had keys to my place. I was in therapy for years, and my therapists urged me to live my own life, but my mother couldn't let me go. I think the first decision I made totally alone was when I was 54 and planning her funeral. She loved me, but not enough to let me go and stand on her own. That's not really mother love, is it? The enmeshed daughter disappears in the hot glare of her mother's attention. This daughter lacks a sense of self because her mother only sees her daughter as an extension of herself and observes no boundaries. The way out of this especially tangled relationship is very difficult and singular because even though the daughter may feel as though she's choked by the connection, she may also feel loved. It's a thorny paradox. These mothers actually do love their daughters, but the degree to which they engulf them is wounding nonetheless. It's the mother's own neediness that trumps all. The classic example of the enmeshed mother is the stage mother. Gypsy Rose Lee, Frances Farmer, and some contemporary stars had them, or those who hope to live off of, be enriched by, or aggrandized by their daughter's achievements or status. Still others, such as the mother of Vivian Gornick, as portrayed in her memoir Fierce Attachments, look to live through their daughters vicariously. These mothers are usually single, widowed, or divorced, and deprived of other social connections. They experience the world through their daughters and use guilt and other forms of emotional manipulation to keep their daughters tied to them. It's the mother's own unfulfilled needs that drive and define how she connects with her daughter. The enmeshed daughter is often an only child, but she may also be the last born of a number of children who are separated by many years. Not knowing where she begins and mom ends, this daughter looks to her mother for everything from advice to company, unconsciously subjugating her own needs and wants, if she can even recognize them, to her mother's. During childhood and adolescence, the daughter may chafe at her mother's intrusiveness, but often she simply gives in and settles into the routines dictated by the person who says she always knows best. Young adulthood often presents a crisis for the daughter as she tries to find her own voice and her mother pushes back. Some enmeshed daughters make it to college and may manage to live on their own, but others fail, moving back to the safety and oxygen-deprived atmosphere of their childhood rooms. Enmeshed daughters have great difficulty resolving the problem until they seek professional help, and even then, it can be an uphill battle. Patterns of enmeshment may also emerge from relationships with self-absorbed or narcissistic mothers who also see their daughters as extensions of themselves. These patterns are a bit different since the enmeshment is one-sided and driven by the daughter's need to please her mother and stay within her orbit. The mother, in fact, is not enmeshed but a solitary star dictating her daughter's path. Enmeshed daughters are sometimes able to salvage their relationships to their mothers by enforcing strict boundaries. These mothers aren't actually unloving, they just lack the ability to allow their daughters to breathe and be. Common effects of the enmeshed style. Alternating feelings of anger, guilt, and emotional confusion. Impaired sense of self. Difficulties being independent and articulating and acting on her own needs. Unhealthy coping mechanisms. Inability to see the core conflict clearly. The role-reversed mother. Anecdotally, at least, this is the least reported pattern and usually happens when a mother is young or overburdened. She has too many responsibilities or children and not enough resources, is physically or mentally ill, or has experienced some other kind of life-altering crisis. The child, usually the oldest but sometimes the most capable, is thrust into the role of caretaker, no matter her age, and effectively becomes the mother in the family. These mothers aren't necessarily unloving. In fact, many of them love their children deeply, but are rendered incapable for one reason or another. That said, there's no denying the damage they wreak. They rob their daughters of their childhoods and girlhoods, put burdens on them that they're not ready to take on, and force them to take on inappropriate adult roles. Amy, a 32-year-old, shared her story. My father died suddenly and unexpectedly when I was 13 and my little brother was 10. My mother fell apart and became very depressed, spending most of her time in bed. My dad's parents lived too far away to help. My mom's parents didn't really have time and had issues of their own. Everyone chalked it up to mourning and thought it would stop. It didn't. I was the mom for 5 years, cooking, cleaning, taking care of my brother. I didn't have time to see friends or date. I did poorly in school. I got married at 18 just to escape. That marriage fell apart, and when my brother turned 18 and I refused to come home to care for her, she finally got help. We still talk, but I am scarred and guarded. Sometimes the daughter is pushed into the role of best friend or confidant to a lonely mother, which prevents her from being a child, burdens her with too much adult information, and blurs all the important boundaries. This relationship inflicts its own kind of damage, as Grace, 39, told me. My father divorced my mother, moved away, and remarried when I was 6. Did you see that movie Anywhere But Here? That was my life. My mother wanted me to mother her, listen to her, support her. She wouldn't let me be a kid, and, you know, she's the same now that I'm an adult. Being with her is like being in a room without air. I don't exist. This pattern of relationship is different from the others, and there is often reconciliation between these mothers and daughters, as whatever obstacles that stood in the way of the mother's functioning are addressed or improved. This isn't to say that the relationship doesn't affect the daughter's development. It does. But it is also always clear that what's happening has nothing to do with the daughter herself. She never feels at fault or blamed or somehow responsible. She may also have compassion for her mother's predicament, even as she chafes at the role she's been forced to take on. All of that makes a huge difference. Common effects of role-reversed mothering. Experience of a lost childhood. Being forced into maturity the daughter isn't ready for. Often poor social skills and a feeling of isolation. Feeling conflicted. Daughter loves her mother, but also resents her. Great difficulty with forming close and intimate relationships. Using the 8 behaviors for understanding. Very few women report just a single behavior dominating their childhoods and young adulthoods. Almost everyone says that their mothers displayed one or more at various times. You'll note that I've used unscientific descriptions, and I've done that deliberately, even in the case of the self-involved mother, whom I've declined to call a narcissist. One reason is that I'm not a therapist or psychologist. But even if I were, I couldn't diagnose someone I hadn't talked to. The second is that while there's a reassurance and aha moment in realizing that your mother's a narcissist or maybe borderline, it doesn't focus you on what happened to you. Daughter detox is about you, not her. Her behavior is only important as an aid in seeing how you were shaped and affected. The point of these categories is for you to start understanding how you were treated with some specificity. There's a lot of unconscious process that prevents you from really seeing how you were affected. That's why seeing your wounds is so hard. The more experience is brought into the light, out of the murk of unconsciousness, the better equipped you'll be to stop the past from leaking into and directing the flow of the present. The arsenal. Verbal abuse in all of its forms. Verbal aggression and abuse are usually part of the daughter's emotional landscape, although she may not recognize either except in hindsight. Some of that has to do with the child accepting that what goes on in her house is normal because she has nothing to compare it to. Remember that her world is tiny, and the interpretation of that world is controlled by her parents. Harsh words are often justified by mothers as disciplinary in nature or a necessary corrective. I wouldn't have to get angry if you didn't mess up all the time. Additionally, Abusive mothers marginalize or deny the pain of verbal abuse, which adds to the child's confusion and shame. They're just words. Stop being a crybaby and grow a spine. One daughter, now 47 and a mother herself, described what it was like. My mother filled the house with her rage and yelling, but told me I had no right to be sad or to be angry, that I should be glad I was being fed and clothed. She shamed me for reacting. She sabotaged and mocked me when something made me happy or feel proud, and I felt myself getting smaller and smaller. I tried very hard to disappear, you know? But not all abuse is loud or even articulated. In fact, counterintuitively enough, some of the worst kinds of verbal abuse are quiet. Silence in answer to a question asked or a comment made can pack a mightier wallop than a loud rant. Silence effectively ridicules and shames. The child subjected to quiet abuse often experiences more emotional confusion than one who's being yelled at or insulted, precisely because the absence of rage sends mixed signals, and the motivation behind willful silence or a refusal to answer is impossible for a child to read. There's a special kind of hurt in being treated as though you're invisible or that you are so unimportant in the scheme of things that you're not even worth answering. Is there anything more chilling and hurtful than seeing your mother act as though she can't see you, her face calm? Everything science knows about the effects of verbal abuse applies to the quiet variety, too. Following are the different kinds of subtle verbal abuse you might have experienced. Being ignored. Because much of the information children have about the world and relationships comes to them secondhand, the child with a mother who ignores her learns that her place in the world is precarious, even though she doesn't know why, and even worse, generalizes that most relationships make you feel bad about yourself. Remember the effect that Edward Tronick's still-face experiments had on babies and toddlers, how those children had to self-protect? Well, being ignored 24/7 effectively disappears a child's sense of self instead of validating it, and she learns that avoidance doesn't hurt, but expectation of engagement does. That, too, is abusive. Stonewalling. From a child's perspective, being stonewalled may seem very much like being ignored, but it has different emotional consequences, especially as she matures. She's likely to recognize this abuse by the time she's an adolescent, which will increase volatility in the household, depending on whether she fights back or folds her tents. It's the younger child who's especially vulnerable. The child's lack of developed and effective defense mechanisms is precisely what researchers in Israel homed in on when they examined the long-term effects of childhood emotional abuse. They concluded that the damage done to individuals' self-esteem had much to do with their inability to protect and defend themselves and to internalizing the thought that they weren't good enough to warrant their parents' attention when parents were uncaring or harshly controlling. Contempt and derision. Shaming a child can be accomplished sotto voce or even with physical gestures like eye-rolling or laughing at her to convey contempt or making her the butt of jokes. This particular variety of bullying can become a team sport in some households if siblings are asked to join the fray and make the child a scapegoat. Controlling parents, or those who need to be the center of attention, often use these techniques to maintain the dynamics of the household as they want them. Once again, damage can be done without a raised voice. Gaslighting. This tool of manipulation is aimed at having the child doubt her perceptions. The term derives from a play, Gaslight, which was then made into a movie about a man who tries to convince a woman she's losing her mind. Gaslighting doesn't require shouting or yelling. All it takes is a simple statement that something that actually happened didn't. given the imbalance of power in the parent-child relationship and the fact that a young child accepts the adult as the last word and authority on most things until she gets old enough to begin questioning her mother's judgment, gaslighting is relatively easy. Gaslighting not only makes a child worry about being crazy, but also erodes her confidence in her own thoughts and feelings in a profound and lasting way. Again, keep in mind that children don't have conscious defense mechanisms. Hypercriticality. In many households, both the loud and the quiet kinds of verbal abuse are rationalized by the need to correct perceived flaws in the child's character or behavior. Hypercriticality, nitpicking and then magnifying every misstep or mistake, may be justified or explained by having to make sure the child isn't too full of herself, doesn't let her successes go to her head, learns humility, knows who's boss, and other self-serving statements that are just excuses for cruel adult behavior. Delivered in a quiet tone, the barrage of criticism makes a child believe she's unworthy of attention and support because she's worthless. The absence of praise, support, and love. The power of what isn't said cannot be overstated because the void it leaves in the child's psyche and heart is enormous, and yes, it's emotionally abusive. Children are hardwired to need all the things that the unloving mother neither voices nor demonstrates in order to thrive and develop normally. In truth, words that articulate why a child is worthy of love and attention are as essential as food, water, clothing, and shelter. Normalizing or excusing the abuse. As I've already mentioned, it's a sad truth that a child's world is so small that she thinks what goes on in it goes on everywhere. Most children attribute verbal abuse to their flaws and badness. As Rachel Goldsmith and Jennifer Frey note, this attribution may actually be less scary than the scarier prospect that the caregiver can't be trusted and may help create an illusion of control. Even as adults, those verbally abused in the quiet manner during childhood may rationalize or normalize their parents' behaviors for many different reasons. Maternal power, that ability to dictate how things that happen in the household are interpreted, and the daughter's acceptance of what happens at home as normal, stand in the way of her seeing how she's being emotionally abused. Then, too, her continuing need for her mother's love also keeps her more focused on somehow turning things around than analyzing the real dynamics. She's more apt to look for reasons why her mother treats her as she does and make excuses for the behavior rather than confront the terrible and painful truth. This is what I call the dance of denial. It's little wonder that so many daughters struggle for decades long after their childhoods are officially over. Moving from discovery to discernment. You may be feeling a sense of relief at this moment, seeing the ways in which your mother behaved expressed in black and white, along with the recognition that other girls had experiences similar to yours. As one woman wrote after being on my Facebook page, "It's strange how knowing that I have company in this awful situation, that others have gone through what I did and felt some of the same feelings of isolation and hurt, has made me feel better and less daunted." The list of the toxic patterns of maternal behavior is meant to be used as a tool for you to begin seeing how her actions and inactions, what she said and what she didn't say, affected your own reactions and behavior in the past, and continue to do so in the present. Recognizing your own mental models of relationship, your predominant attachment style, is a necessary step in the process. These first two chapters have sketched the terrain the unloved daughter finds herself in. The following two will begin the process of untangling the threads that form the tapestry of your personal experiences. It's what I call discernment, And the first stop is taking a close look at the family of origin and its dynamics. Chapter 3. All in the Family. Understanding Ripple Effects. There were four of us growing up, two boys and two girls. My brothers got all the attention, which I resented when I was young, but now I see that wasn't necessarily a good thing. Our mother was enmeshed and controlling in the boys' lives and dismissive of my sister and me. My sister is the youngest, and she simply went her own way. I was the needy one, desperate to please my mother and get my father's attention. Nothing worked. I married the first guy I dated at 18, and that set me on a path for a life of underachieving. I divorced him and married another. Now I'm 45 and trying to reroute my life. I don't speak to anyone in my family other than my sister. Clarice, 45. A mother's treatment of her daughter doesn't take place in a vacuum, of course. The drama plays out in a household, each of which has its own unique aspects. This chapter marks the first step toward discernment, being able to see and then fully understand both the ways in which your childhood experiences were similar to those of others and the ways in which they were different and unique. Each pathway to healing is, in the details, singular because we are all individuals with our signature quirks and ways of seeing the world. Once again, we will begin with the broadest of brushstrokes so that you can locate your experiences in the common threads and then begin to see the differences. As small children, the world of the family is the only one we know. We may feel its undercurrents, the arguments between our parents, shifts in routine that may signal larger changes of which we're unaware, but we have no way of knowing whether this family is like the other families we see out in the greater world. Everything that happens in this little world affects us in small ways and large, even though we don't know that as children. One of the largest obstacles to our healing as adults is the young self still inside each of us who, in the hope of feeling at one with the family and belonging to it, still believes that what happened was normal, or that if it wasn't quite normal, the dynamic can somehow be fixed or altered, even now. Family dynamics, the interactions among the individuals within the group, are defined by both presences and absences. The presence of siblings or the absence of them, the presence of a father or the absence of one, the presence of extended family or its absence, the presence of addiction or its absence, the presence of stability in all of its forms and its absence. And then, too, there is the presence or absence of love and attunement. The presence or absence of aggression, anger, manipulation, and chaos. The presence or absence of mutual support, respect, and caring. Each family is different, although there are discernible patterns that aid our understanding. While this book focuses on a specific lack, maternal support and love, the losses suffered by a daughter usually involve other relationships as well. Depending on the dynamic, wresting love from her father may be as hopeless a task as trying to get it from her mother. Then there is the sibling connection, the relationship that can potentially span more decades of life than any other. For many daughters, sibling relationships become the locus of more pain and loss. All of these experiences, fallout from the maternal relationship, also mark the daughter in specific ways. Forgetting the image of the scales. Colloquially, when we talk about relationships and their pluses and minuses, we often use images that summon up scales, employing words like balance out when we're focused on the pros of staying in or, when we're not, referencing the thing or things that tipped the scales and made us bail. There's only one problem with the imagery and the vocabulary, especially as we move toward understanding how the dynamics of our family worked and affected us. They're not accurate. You may remember that, in the first chapter, I wrote about how bad is stronger than good, and how bad events and negative emotions affect us much more quickly and deeply than positive ones, and how they're stored in the brain for easy retrieval, and how the verbal expression of caring by one parent doesn't do anything to mitigate or buffer the effect of verbal aggression by the other. A study of some 2,000 adults in their 60s showed that, when it came to telling their life stories, painful events were recalled quite differently even when there'd been a long interval of time since they occurred, with the exception of childhood trauma. The researchers concluded that older adults perceived positive events as central to their lives largely because of cultural norms, but that negative events were perceived as central or a turning point because of coping skills and emotional distress. Well, all of that is part of a larger psychological truth. The systems that process good events and experiences and bad ones are separate and run parallel to each other. So there's no weighing, no balance, no tipping, no offset. As you approach the task of discerning the patterns of interaction in your family of origin, you need to make an effort to keep them objectively and separately, and not in concert. Being treated well by your father may have helped build your sense of self, but it did little to assuage the wounding your mother's disparagement inflicted. The unseen player, the marriage between your parents. The roles mothers and fathers play in their children's lives, whether they are essentially loving and caring parents or not, are usually closely tied to the relationship the two adults have to each other. Small children aren't really in a position to understand the relationship except in the most obvious of ways. You may have parents who are usually laughing and hugging, or grow up in a place where slammed doors and yelling are the norm. But the dynamic of that central relationship, is it one in which each partner listens to the other and compromises are made to benefit the couple, or is it one that is all about power? Inevitably spills over onto how both mother and father parent. How happy your mother and father are in the relationship matters too, of course, and shapes all of the family's interactions, as does whether his or her individual expectations are being met by the other partner. It's very easy for marital dissatisfaction to become anger directed at a child. And, of course, the breakdown of that relationship, if it occurs, whether it ends in an amicable divorce, a prolonged battle lasting years, or a literal disappearing act, spills out and over onto each child in the family in a very personal way. As adults, we can finally begin to see the subterranean currents in our parents' marriages we felt washing up against us as children but couldn't identify. The other grown-up, your father. Research shows that in healthy families, fathers contribute to a child's development in significant ways through actions, words, modeling of behavior, and displays of affection. Paternal influence may be key in teaching a child to regulate emotions through the roughhouse style of play that fathers tend to favor, as well as helping a child form a cognitive perspective on empathy in childhood and adolescence. In a healthy family, the dyad of husband and wife is actually strengthened by the expansion to include the child in a new triad, even though it may take conscientious effort. A few studies make it clear that the father's influence isn't insubstantial. For example, one by Jennifer Bird Craven, Brandon J. Auer, and others, showed that a daughter's relationship to her father plays a significant role in her management of stress. Measuring for cortisol, a hormone released by stress, researchers noted that cortisol levels went down with warm and caring connections between father and daughter. Daughters in relationships that were more negative and not close showed both higher levels of cortisol and increased sensitivity to emotional changes and an inability to inhibit reactivity. Something else happens when a mother is unloving or rejecting. When we become parents, each of us, whether it's the role of mother or father we're about to take on, brings to the table not just our own childhood experiences, but also our ideas, all of them untested and many of them not totally articulated, about how best to rise to the challenges of parenting and the desirable or proper role each parent should play. The childhoods of daughters and sons, raised from the 1940s to the 1970s, were shaped by traditional views of the father as the breadwinner, rule-setter, and disciplinarian, and the mother as in charge of raising children and running the home. For most of these daughters of unloving mothers, the role of the father was culturally and socially marginalized, which had real-life consequences. But recent research reveals that, even now, the involvement of fathers continues to be limited since, even in these more enlightened times, mothering is seen as more important than fathering, and raising children continues to be a woman's turf, as does the care of the home, even in households with two wage earners. It turns out that mothers end up deciding whether or not and to what degree fathers are involved in child rearing, a phenomenon called maternal gatekeeping. When a mother gatekeeps, she criticizes, disparages, or discourages her husband's efforts at child rearing. As a result, fathers are likely to withdraw from active roles. Almost 20 years ago, Mary DeLucy's work revealed that both the stability of the marriage and the wife's support were strong predictors of paternal involvement with their children. Interestingly, the more negative the mother's experience had been with her own father, the more eager she was for her husband to be an active parent. Daughters of rejecting fathers were also more likely to be supportive and happy with their husband's efforts. More recent research, including that of Sarah Shoppy Sullivan, sees maternal gatekeeping as a significant factor when co-parenting fails. Unloving, rejecting, and controlling mothers tend to be described by their daughters as expert gatekeepers. They want control of what has traditionally been a woman's turf. For some daughters of unloving mothers, the father's mere presence at home helps to de-escalate the criticism and hostility. For other daughters, though, their closeness to their fathers will heighten the conflict with a jealous or competitive mother, or a highly self-involved one who wants the attention of the man of the house all to herself. A father who is emotionally withdrawn from the household, present in fact, but essentially absent by choice, can increase the confusion the unloved daughter feels and add to her feelings of abandonment and betrayal. The truly absentee father, either through divorce or because he simply skipped out, affects the unloved daughter in yet another way. Again, I've given thoroughly unspecific descriptions of some of the roles fathers can play in the dynamic of the mother-daughter relationship and in the one-on-one relationship with their daughters. Sometimes, behaviors will overlap or change over time. Keep in mind that these patterns are meant only as tools to help you sort out and understand the role your own father played in your childhood and later. The yes man. Whether he does it consciously or unconsciously, this father becomes a co-conspirator with the mother. In some cases, the mother makes sure that she doesn't say or do anything hurtful to her daughter in her husband's presence. In others, where the behavior is witnessed, the mother quickly shifts the blame onto the daughter. No matter what rationale is offered, the child needed correction, was disobedient or disrespectful, is too sensitive. The father buys into it. Dad's joining Team Mom makes it easy for the daughter to consider herself responsible for her mother's lack of love. With Mom and Dad teamed up, the daughter may be wary of all relationships with both women and men. Some yes men don't team up with their wives but end up playing the appeaser role, which is a variation on the theme. Their commitment to the marriage and their own acceptance of how their spouses act, that's just who she is, or she means well, she's doing it for your own good. trump all, and lead them to actively encourage their daughters to feel the same. Unfortunately, by acting as appeasers, they further marginalize and deny their daughters' perceptions and feelings. These men may have some measure of love and affection for their daughters, but ignore or look away from maternal treatment and its consequences, since their first allegiance is to team spouse and marriage. Their consistent lack of support results in emotional confusion and more complicated issues of trust. The chorus. It's sad but true that some unloved daughters report growing up with two emotionally abusive parents, each for his or her own reasons, who take their grievances out on a single child or a number of them. Yes, fathers can be unloving too, and sometimes, horribly enough, an unloved daughter finds herself in a situation where the messages, even if different, are all negative, all the time, separate from the dynamics of the marriage. The King of the Castle. As counterintuitive as it sounds, the presence of a loving and involved father can actually complicate the dynamic in the household in destructive ways. His closeness to his daughter can quickly become a catalyst for escalated conflict, especially as the daughter gets older, since the mother perceives the attention her daughter's getting as rightfully hers. Jealous, competitive, or self-involved mothers will often see the daughter as a potential rival for what she thinks of as her throne by the king's side. Mothers who competed for their father's attention as daughters, my mother was one, are especially susceptible to feeling threatened. These mothers will escalate the warfare by amplifying their criticism of their daughters and doing what they can to turn their husbands into yes-men. The more unstable the marriage is, the more the father's affection for his daughter looks like a threat to the safety of her mother's world. Sometimes the daughter becomes a stand-in for the other woman, real or imagined. As daughters tell it, the King of the Castle scenario is very toxic and impossible to resolve. Jealousy heats up a mother's behaviors, no matter what form they take, and spurs on her vindictiveness and meanness. The daughter effectively doesn't have a chance. The absentee. Sometimes, daughters discover that both parents are equally emotionally unavailable, even if their parenting styles are very different. Some daughters report that their controlling mothers controlled their husbands as well, and these fathers tended to disappear into the woodwork. While the yes man joins team mom, the absentee simply stays out of the fray as much as he can. This is what Sarah recounted. I have practically no memory of my father that doesn't involve television or his shop in the basement. He ate dinner in silence, never asked about my day, and disappeared once he put down his fork. Until I was an adult, he was a cipher to me. In troubled marriages, fathers often emotionally vacate the premises long before they leave, and some of them don't ever leave, and spend more time at work, out of the house, and attending to hobbies and sports outside of the familial circle. Extramarital affairs remove them even farther from the emotional center of the family and, of course, their daughters. The emotional pain inflicted on daughters by the lack of maternal love is compounded by the sense that their fathers have abandoned them and failed to protect them, leaving them alone and at their mother's mercy. Daughters report a great deal of emotional confusion when fathers are absent, and if their mothers end up abandoned by their fathers, they may actually align themselves with their mothers, creating another kind of inner conflict. The need for mother love rises to the surface, and loyalty to the mother in these circumstances sometimes outweighs the need for self-protection. Parental divorce creates a special conundrum for daughters of unloving mothers who usually end up living with their mothers. Daughters of enmeshed mothers will find the going very rough, as whatever slight boundaries once existed disappear under stress. An older daughter may be able to recognize that her father has left because he's been treated the way she has, and that can lift the burden of feeling responsible for the failure of the maternal relationship and create an enduring alliance with the father, even if the time spent with him is scanty. Even though these fathers are physically absent from their daughters' lives, they are nonetheless emotionally present and caring.